This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts.
Many of Tim's family had served in World War I and World War II, and from a young age he was determined to follow their path. Overcoming huge competition for places, he becomes a driver of the Leopard AS1 main battle tank at the 1st Armoured Regiment of the Australian Army. Australia is largely ignored by most Cold War histories. However, we hear how the Australian Army prepared to fight the Musorians, a thinly disguised notional enemy which was obviously the Soviets or one of their satellites in everything but name. I'm delighted to welcome Tim to our Cold War conversation.
I was born in 1969 in a little country town called Yarram in the state of Victoria, down in the southeastern corner of Australia. An idyllic upbringing, really. Little bush community, great parents. I don't have one of those raised in a family of violence stories or anything like that that often come out of the Cold War and defence service. I was taught to shoot and hunt and move through the bush by my dad, my grandfather. Went to school, enjoyed school. Just a lovely rural upbringing, really. And went to the Boy Scouts, joined the Boy Scouts, and met a fellow there. He was my scout leader, and he was in the Army Reserve, in the local regiment called the Prince of Wales's Light Horse. And every so often he'd turn up in his uniform, and there was this mystique about him, and at least to me. And also, in that little rural community, we held our Anzacs, as heroes. And on Anzac Day, the 25th of April each year, I used to see them march in the parade, and these old fellas with straight backs and medals on their chest. And I thought, I want to be one of those guys one day. So, yeah, that's basically my upbringing, just this classic Australian rural childhood. It was beautiful, really.
And was there a history of serving in the military in your family?
First and Second World War. My great-grandfather, he was an infantryman on the Somme, etc. On my grandmother's side, there was four brothers. Four of her uncles went off to war, and three of them were killed in France. There was other cousins that had served in Gallipoli, etc. In the Second World War, my pa's uncles and cousins had all fought against the Germans and Japanese in the Second World War as well. So my mother's uncles were commandos against the Japanese up in Borneo in the Second World War. So, yeah, I guess there's a pretty significant history of service in my family. My father didn't go to Vietnam. He said he was willing to go if he was called, but he wasn't called. And so, that never happened. So I guess it skipped that generation, but I certainly wanted to get into service.
Well, that's certainly a very rich military heritage you've just described there. And I think a lot of people forget that Australia was involved in Vietnam. Many people see it as solely a US-led war. But we'll come on to Vietnam in a little while. So with this scout leader, he's quite a big influence for you, it sounds like. What steps did you take to join the military?
Yeah, he was a great mentor to me, and I kind of wanted to emulate him, I guess. And so you could join the Army Reserve or the regular Army in Australia at the time from 17, as long as you had your parents' permission. And I thought to myself, I might get a head start on that. And so I turned up at about 16 and a half at the local Army Reserve depot and thought, oh, it'll take them a while to work out that I'm underaged. And anyway, it didn't take them long at all to work out that I was underage, and they said, go away, come back when you're 17 with the form signed. And so I swore the oath to Her Majesty on my 17th birthday. I'd badgered my parents for years and had the forms all filled out, everything ready to go. So I think on the day of my 17th birthday, I turned up at the Army Reserve Depot, and they were happy to swear me in. And that's when it all started. That was June 1986.
So. What was your role within that reserve regiment?
The Prince Wales Light Horse at the time was a medium reconnaissance regiment in the Armoured Corps. They were fielding M113 A1s, the American APC, which we'd bought in 1965. We bought them new off the Americans and used them right through Vietnam. And they've soldiered on. They're still serving those wagons in upgraded form. But, yeah, so they were using those as a light reconnaissance vehicle. In every troop as well, there was two of those, but they were fitted with the British Scorpion 76mm turrets. They were called medium reconnaissance vehicles. And so they were an Australian hybrid of the American M113 and the British Scorpion CVRT. So they were a very interesting thing. And also in each troop, the Delta vehicle was an armoured personnel carrier. It carried a recon scout section, as we would call it now. Back then we called ourselves assault troopers. So they were like armoured infantry, but specialising in reconnaissance, dismounted reconnaissance and security of that armoured group when it went firm at night. So I started out as an assault trooper, which was an incredible course. Lots of dismounted infantry work, surveillance, shooting every weapon in the Australian, armoured corps inventory. So the 30 calibre Browning machine gun, the 50 calibre Browning machine gun, the M72 66mm short range anti-armour weapon, the 84mm Carl Gustav, or Charlie Gutsake, as we used to call it, the Wombat gun, the M79 40mm grenade launcher, M60 general purpose machine gun, the L2A1 heavy barreled version of the SLR rifle, as well as the SLR and the hated F1 submachine gun, which was an Australian submachine gun, 9mm, a bit like the Sterling submachine gun that was in British service, but just no one liked the 9mm. We shot all those, did radio work, and I deployed on a couple of exercises with that unit while I was still a reservist, and also trained as a M113A1 driver. So I was pretty busy. I'd finished high school at that time and had nothing else to do, so I just put my hand up for every course that I could. And so my introduction into the Army Reserve, it's supposed to be every Tuesday and the occasional weekend and the occasional 2-week exercise, but for me it was pretty intense. I was there all the time and on courses, so loved it. Just loved it. Loved being in the uniform. Loved deploying to the field. I feel like I was a field soldier more than a parade ground soldier, and really got a taste for the Army. And there were a couple of old Vietnam veterans as what we called Carter staff. They were regular Army fellows that coordinated the training for the reservists, etc. And both of those guys, Kev Hunter and Terry Thistlewaite, took me under their wing, and they knew I wanted to go into the regular Army, and they certainly encouraged me and facilitated me in doing that. So about 18 months after I joined the reserve, I signed up for the regular Army.
Before we get to the regular Army, I'm just interested to know, Australia is a long way away from Europe and sort of like the hot borders of the Cold War. Who was going to be your enemy? Who were you training to fight against?
At the time, in the 80s, we were in that post-Vietnam cringe. During the Vietnam period, obviously, there was no doubt who we were going to fight. It was the communists through Southeast Asia, and because, you know, our guys were actually doing that. And there was still a bit of a lingering suspicion that, you know, any real threat to our country would have come through the archipelago to our north, communist influence, I guess. But we had a notional training enemy, and they called it the Missourian Armed Forces. And I look back on it now and I chuckle away. The Missourian Armed Forces kind of had Soviet equipment, Soviet doctrine. They looked like Soviets. They had a few funny little Southeast Asian aspects to them, but yeah, generally they were the Soviets. And it was, you know, the Australian Army has always been an expeditionary army. And so, you know, there was always the assumption that we would end up either fighting in Australia for Australia or being exported somewhere else to, you know, to fight for Australia's national interests. So, you know, although we're not a NATO member, we're always closely aligned with NATO, and, you know, we have exchange programs with the British and Americans. So there was no doubt that we were an add-on to a NATO force, at least in the eyes of, you know, the people that were actually carrying the rifles, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think you sent me quite an interesting training document with the Manchurian arm described in that, and we might be sharing that in the episode notes because it's a very interesting read.
Yeah, they're funny. They, you know, they look like Soviets, they act like Soviets, but we weren't allowed to call them Soviets.
Was there an expectation at the time that you might be used as an expeditionary force, like in World War One and World War Two?
That's pretty much all we've ever done in our armed forces. So, yeah, I guess that expectation's always there. You know, like the older guys that were still serving that had served in Vietnam, you know, they didn't spend their time painting rocks in Australia. They trained and then they deployed to Southeast Asia, you know, Vietnam, Malaya, et cetera, et cetera. So there's, you know, you're getting your wisdom from those guys. So, yes.
Yeah.
We were never going to hang around and defend Australia until after the Cold War. Then the focus changed on continental defence, I guess, for a little while. But certainly during the Cold War, yeah, it was expeditionary. Our mindset was expeditionary.
So let's go back to you joining the regular army. Can you just take me through those first days and weeks there?
Yeah, okay. When you joined the regular army in Australia, at the time, the reserve and the regular army, you know, we wore the same uniform and carried the same weapons, etc., but, you know, they didn't really get on. The regular army used to look at the reservists, they'd call them chocos, chocolate soldiers, you know, in a disparaging way. And so when I signed up for the regular army, you don't get any credit for any training you've already done at the time. So I had to start from scratch. I turned up at Melbourne at the recruiting centre there. And, you know, they were all very nice to you. You swear the oath again to Her Majesty the Queen, her heirs and successors. They put you on a bus and you drive for, I don't know, I think it's about 6 hours to 1st Recruit Training Battalion at Kapooka there in New South Wales. Then the shock starts. It's just like all the war movies. There's footprints painted on the pavement outside the bus, and someone gets on the bus and starts screaming at you, and you don't know what day it is. And I thought I was prepared for the Kapooka experience because I'd had reserve experience, but oh no, it was a big shock. It was a big shock. And so you spend 12 weeks there. And when I was there, it was still the days of bastardization, we used to call it, you know, like they were pretty tough. All the sergeants there, well, many of the sergeants were war veterans, Vietnam veterans. And, you know, the corporals were in charge of your day-to-day life, and they were wanting to impress those war veterans, I guess. And so it was pretty tough, physically tough, mentally tough.
Did you have any choice as to where you were going to end up following your basic training?
That you do within within sort of defence requirements, I guess. So they asked you to do a list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, of what you're core mustering. So the vast majority of the guys in my training platoon at Kapuka, their 23 platoon, they ended up in the infantry regardless of what they actually written down. It's quite competitive. So the better you perform at Kapuka, the more chance you've got of getting your choice. So there were two positions available for armour, and I'd put armour as my number one. You know, the first reason for that was I'd already been in an armoured corps unit in the reserves, and, you know, I kind of liked it. But the main reason was they have all these PR films that they used to show you on an old projector. You know, it's hard to fathom that we used to use projectors then, but they'd put on a projector and they had all these PR films showing what the jobs were in each corps. So they had the infantry, you know, walking around with rifles and bayonets and machine guns, etc., and, you know, the signals corps operating radios. But then they put the armoured corps one, and on that film they showed these Leopard main battle tanks, you know, and I thought, oh my God, I'd never even considered that, but they were, you know, on this film, they just looked awesome. You know, like they were dark and menacing looking, and the firepower was incredible. I thought, wow, maybe I want that. Yeah, I wasn't entirely sure yet, but I knew I wanted to go to the Armoured Corps. So I put down Armoured Corps, and I was lucky enough to have performed well enough that they freed up a slot for me. So on March out, I was allocated to the Royal Australian Armoured Corps.
Okay, and I guess your sort of reserve experience in that Armoured Reconnaissance Regiment may have helped to some degree there, in so much that you did know how to drive a tracked vehicle.
It did later. You try and hide that you're a reservist, to be honest. You know, you want to be the grey man while you're in training. You just want to look like you're performing really well, but for no real reason, because if they find out you're a choco, they'd give you some hard treatment. So I just kept my head down. Of course, they had access to my records and things, but, you know, some of these corporals could never have been accused of being great readers. So I just shut my mouth and head down, ass up, as they say, and just performed. I was just a young kid, and, I could keep up on all the runs, and, you know, I had the right level of aggression, and, you know, I guess I could march up and down the square and shoot okay. In fact, shooting, I was more than okay, because I was, you know, like I said, I was born with a rifle in my hand, thanks to my relatives and, you know, my rural upbringing.
And so how long is the training course at the Armoured Centre?
At the Armoured Centre, it's around about 3 months. You know, like there's different modules. So there's indoctrination, radio, and then DNS, driving and servicing wing. And so there's sometimes little gaps where you're, you know, painting rocks between the various modules. But my course went through pretty quickly. So it went through in about 3-4 months, I guess, from go to woe. So I marched in about March, and I marched out of the Armoured Centre in about late June, I think, like that, something like that.
Can you remember the first time you saw the Leopard in the flesh?
The first time I saw a Leopard was while I was in indoctrination, in the indoctrination core training wing there, at doing mine in indoctrination. So you're sitting there in classrooms studying AFV recognition and core history and the 30 caliber machine gun, 50 caliber machine gun, etc. Most of it's classroom work in that phase. Anyway, we got a break. You know, like back then, everyone smoked except for me. So it's 40-minute lesson, 5-minute break. 40-minute lesson, 5-minute break. So they fell us out. How'd you go for a 5-minute break? I went out for a 5-minute passive smoke, you know, and driving up the tank strip beside the building we were operating out of was this beautiful, menacing, dark green Leopard AS1, and it rumbled, and you could hear it, and when it turned, it squeaked and rumbled at the same time, and I thought, oh my God, that is just a thing of beauty and power. So that's the first time I ever saw it. I'll never forget that. Never forget that moment.
And I guess there's no certainty, even though you're in the armored corps, that you're going to be involved with Leopard.
No, no way. Again, it was competitive back then. And, you know, the armored corps guys, the instructors all knew I was a former Choco in the Cav, you know, that I was qualified in M113. So there was no hiding that. But again, when you put in your preferences, I put in that I wanted to be tank driver at the First Armored Regiment. And again, I must have performed well enough that I was lucky enough to get my first preference. I really thought I was going to end up in the cavalry, which, you know, I guess what you know, what you don't know, you don't know. So if I had have ended up in the cavalry, that would have been just fine, I guess. But I really wanted to get behind the sticks of a tank or the wheel of a tank, and I was lucky enough to do well enough indoctrination and radio that I got my first choice, which was tank driver. So the final phase of the IET course, as it's called, the initial employment training course, was you move out of the all corps training phases, corps indoctrination and radio, into driving and servicing, where you specialise on your platform, your vehicle. So over to D&S wing, driving and servicing wing, and you're in the hands of a sergeant in a crew, and that's where you start to train. And so I marched over to D&S wing and started working with Leopard AS1 every day.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. Now, the Leopard's quite known for its speed. What was it like to drive?
Compared to the M113, it was like a Porsche sports car, mate. It went like shit off a shovel. I'm not sure if I can say that, but it was quick, and it soaked up ground that would break an M113 in half. So this thing, you just pointed it. You didn't have to throw it around across country. Instructors, you know, again, these old boys that had been, you know, driving tanks for or instructing tanks for years, you know, they trained you from day one. There's two speeds on this vehicle, and that's flat out and stop. Flat out in a Leopard AS1 across country is something to behold. Yeah, it was a very agile, fast tank, quick off the mark. The suspension, you know, for a tank of its generation, it was unbelievably fast and agile. And so its main defense is clearly speed. Yeah, absolutely awe-inspiring to get behind the, you know, behind the wheel in the driver's seat of that thing for the first time, put the accelerator to the floor and just feel the difference between M113 and that thing was just unbelievable. Hitting ground that, you know, I would slow down because I was used to driving M113, and this instructor would say, hook in, hook in, hook in. And you'd put your foot flat to the floor, and eventually you learn to appreciate the ground that this particular platform can soak up, and it is amazing. Yeah, there was no other armored vehicle in our inventory anyway that could keep up with that thing.
Right, because you sent me a photo of a leopard sort of leaping, I guess, is the best description. I'm assuming that you do that too often. It's not going to do it a lot of good, but it certainly looked impressive to me.
Yeah, that famous, it's kind of famous in the armoured corps, that photo. It's called the leaping leopard photo. And, you know, I don't know if you're going to show it on the episode notes or whatever, but yeah, that photo is an extreme version of what you can do with a leopard. We used to get them airborne all the time, Ian. You know, that you could just pick your ground and these things would soak them up. In fact, there's a bit of an urban myth. I don't know if it's true or not. Let's just say it's true for the purpose of the exercise. The Germans who sold us those leopards new in 1977 saw that photo, the leaping leopard photo, and threatened to void the warranty on them because we were using them in a completely Australian way, let's say. You know, that we understood that speed was its defence, and that's how we operated.
Well, we'd definitely be sharing that photo. Don't worry, Tim.
It's worth a look, isn't it? Yeah.
it's definitely worth a look. So, Tim, in this training, I mean, how intensive is the training? How many hours do you need to have on the leopard before you're sort of cleared?
Okay, so there was about a week, 10 days worth of what they call the details phase, where you're doing all the theory and practice on how to dip the oil and change filters and blah, 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 all the mechanical stuff. You then go into these really rudimentary simulators on how to start up and what different warning lights mean. But you're not simulating any driving. All your training is done in an actual vehicle back then. And so each crewman, you had three trainee crewmen and an instructor commander. And each trainee crewman had to log 18 hours to get his license. And that's 18 hours, mostly in the field, out on the Puckapunyal Range, in all sorts of environments, you know, close country, open country, you know, by day and by night. And I think we had to, of our driving phase, three of them had to be on public roads. So, you know, we'd chuck the tanks on civilian roads and go for a drive. Yeah. So 18 hours in total is the long answer to a short question.
That's a great answer. And I think, you know, while we were working on preparing for this, you mentioned about your volunteering at the Army Tank Museum.
That's right, yeah. Since I've finished my service and finished my working life, I'm now a volunteer at the Tank Museum out at Puckapunyal, just, you know, literally within a stone's throw of where I did my IET training all those years ago. And every so often I get to jump in the driver's hole of a Leopard AS1, just like I did when I was 18 years old. And you forget nothing. That training, yeah, it's testament to the training they gave you back then. They really nailed it home. You know, just through muscle memory, even now I can jump in the hole and I know exactly where to put my hands and feet, and I know where what different lights mean, and you know, you still have, we call it tank sense. You can feel the vehicle and each individual vehicle and what its little idiosyncrasy though. That training they gave you was incredible. You know, like my head is still full of ridiculous tabulated data from the 1980s. Yeah, like I remember virtually everything, which is, it's crazy. You know, I don't remember anything from high school, but I remember all that stuff. It's a waste of brain space, really, isn't it?
It's incredible the amount of rubbish that you retain. Yeah, I can't remember what my wife told me to get from the kitchen, you know, 10 seconds ago or something like that. But I
guess these times are the formative times of your life, you know, where you're first, you know, under real stress, you know, assessment stress, and you're earning adult wages, and, you know, like I guess that's why it stays in there. But, yeah, testament to the design and delivery of that training, all that time back then, it's still in there.
The Leopard must have seemed light years away from the Centurion, which was the previous main battle tank the Australians had.
That's right. We had Centurion Mark V/1 Australian, and they were the tanks that we took to, well, I didn't, but my predecessors took to Vietnam, and they performed incredibly well. You know, they're a much-loved tank, the Cent. You know, that they're quite a heavy tank compared to Leopard. You know, slow. But they hit hard. They're probably the best tank deployed to Vietnam. But as a result of their service in Vietnam, most of those tanks, by the time they went out of service in 77, we bought them in 1955, and they soldiered on until 1977. So they were really tired by the time they went out of service. And there's all these stories, you know, the old fellas used to tell me about, you know, some of them wouldn't even make it to the end of the tank strip to go on an exercise. They were quite unreliable by the time they went out of service. And so the Leopard was quite welcome when it, you know, like I said, it was like a sports car compared to the Centurion.
One of my listeners, James Toms, looks after, or he's a driver for a museum Centurion. And he's often posting videos of him moving it around the yard and, you know, taking it out on various exhibits. And it's, well, it's not necessarily a forgotten tank, but it probably doesn't get as much spotlight as it deserves because, I mean, it served very well in Korea as well.
Yeah, that's right. You know, like in Vietnam, you know, like it saved lives. You know, it saved infantry lives and it saved the lives of its crew. You know, there's some of those Centurions took multiple RPG hits, you know, and, you know, I'm not sure if we lost a crewman to a penetration from an RPG in Vietnam, but certainly we got a few wounded, but mostly it's because of the way we operated them, which was for situational awareness. The commanders, and they have their heads out. Even now we operate a bit like that, so a bit like the Israelis do with the commanders with their heads out, and so you're more prone to be hit by a fragmentation or small arms fire that way, I guess. But the Centurion, I guess like Leopard, it had so many different natures of ammunition that it could bring to a fight, and its number one killer in Vietnam was canister. You know, it had that giant shotgun shell. So they would, you know, at the Battle of Coral Balmoral and Bin Bar, they would use canister to this devastating effect. You know, they would thump it over the top of a bunker, reveal a bunker, and then hit it with the armor-piercing round, the cap ballistic cap round, the big heavy metal slug, break the bunker open and then open it, you know, and then just smash it up with HE at zero range, you know. Like literally zero range from, you know, a few feet from the end of the muzzle. It must have been terrifying to have those Centurions coming at you in Vietnam.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you graduate the correct word, pass out.
Yeah, march out. We used to call it march out, pass out.
March out. Mm. Okay. And you earn the Black Beret.
That's right. Yeah, the when I marched in as a trainee at the Armoured Centre, it was they put these blue berets on you. You know, you wore the corps badge and this blue beret. You know, these issue blue berets too. You know, like they must be made in the '60s, and they're the size of a pizza dish on your head, and you just felt like a trainee. We called them pogues, like all the other, the non-arms corps wore, you know, the cooks and the bottle washers all wore these dark blue. And we were lumped in with them as trainees, and we just couldn't wait to earn our Black Beret. And, you know, so on march out, you're handed your tank license and your Black Beret, and you're able to put that on and you feel pretty good. You know, you're wearing your regimental badge of your new regiment on your Black Beret. And so, so some of us, we decided to throw our blue berets under the tracks of a leopard and do a pivot turn on it, turning it into a, you know, a woolly mound of dust. And that felt very good. that was a great feeling. So, yep, from that time on, we're qualified tank crewmen and walking tall and feeling 10 foot tall. So that was a great feeling marching out of the armament center as a qualified tank driver.
So what is the unit that you're posted to?
Yep, I was posted to 1st Armoured Regiment, which is just over the hill from the Armoured Centre in the same garrison, Pakapunyal. So I went to A Squadron, 3 Troop A Squadron in the 1st Armoured Regiment as the troop sergeant's driver. So that was it was all a bit new and scary because you're no longer training, you're employed, and you're definitely the newbie, as they called you. And there's all these, old soldiers around you that, they know everything. They know all the lurks and the perks and you just try and keep your mouth shut and stay out of trouble for a while because they were proper warriors, those guys. There wasn't a great deal of turnover in the regiment at the time, so some of those tank crewmen had been around for a long time, or seemingly a long time. And so, even the diggers, even the other troopers, you respected them because they had that earned knowledge. So, yeah, you very much felt like the new guy when you marched in.
And this was June 88.
That's right, about June 88 I marched in to the regiment. And the pace of work was pretty high at the time. The regiment was undermanned. We had some people away on another task, and the regiment was preparing to go on a massive exercise over to the old Woomera rocket range, nuclear testing, rocket testing and nuclear testing sites over in South Australia in the outback. And so the tanks were being prepared to go over there. And so, there was a lot of driver training, a lot of gunnery training, all going on all at once, and stowing of tanks and double stowing and double checking, So that was pretty big. And it wasn't long after I marched in that I actually deployed on this exercise where, you could literally drive your tank for days. In a training area that, was as big as some European countries. Incredible. Yeah, it was a real learning curve for me.
I think you'd mentioned to me that it was as large as Belgium.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Huge. But, we'll come on to it later on, but you described there was one the size of Western Europe that you ended up on some range.
Yeah.
We'll come on to that later.
Yeah.
We'll keep that one.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So, I mean, a training area that size, what are you doing each day? Are you advancing, how far are you traveling each day?
Yeah, I remember that first exercise. It was an exercise called Dry Pardis. I don't know why that's retained in my mind, but it was called Dry Pardis, and it put us through all the phases of war. So it was, advance, attack, defend, delay, all those. Advanced to contact, encounter type battles, and it was all pretty much all live firing. So you were fully bombed up the whole time. Green flag flying, red flag flying, which means you're in a live firing environment. Some of those moves, you would drive all day and all night. You were dog tired, and then you would go into a dawn attack or whatever, and live firing. It was unbelievable. And as a young tank driver, with only 18 hours experience, you're in this environment that we've never operated in, Pakapunyal, a completely different environment to Woomera. And I sincerely believe that I hit every hole in the Woomera range area. I was yelled at from pillar to post and, given a few slaps around the back of the head, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm never going to make a tank driver on that exercise. I thought, I just can't read the ground anymore, and we have to go fast. But there was just something about that ground that I didn't perform well. And I was pretty hard on myself, and I swore I would do better. But, you know, it's just, you know, you do get better. And the way we operated those leopards was, like I say, there was no simulators. All our training was live. So I think by the time the Cold War ended, I would have had thousands of hours driving a leopard. You know, I could drive it in my sleep, and often did.
Essentially, you're living on that tank then for days, or is it weeks?
Weeks, yeah. You're just living out of your pack in the little armoured bin there, and sleeping on the back deck. My tank was call sign 13 Alpha. Astro Wally was its name. Not that we ever called them by their name, but we just called them by their call sign. But they all had a name painted on the side, and just living. You know, you're sleeping on them, $3 million electric blanket we used to call the engine deck, you know, and eating from them, you know, just, yeah, every day. That's your home. It's like your mobile home. Mm.
And could they stand that sort of wear and tear? Because, you know, I always think of sort of like major movements of tanks are generally by rail or by road transporter, whereas you're actually driving these things, well, hundreds of kilometres a day by the sound of it, and going down every hole in Woomera.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I learned how to change shock absorbers, put it that way, in Woomera. Like on that exercise, they would have clocked up hundreds of kilometres per vehicle, hundreds. And that's the beauty. The Leopard could take it. It could take it. It was a beautiful tank. You know, it soaked, like I say, it soaked up the terrain. Yeah, as long as you kept the pads and the road wheels up to it, you know, the track pads and the road wheels, you know, they would shed a bit. You know, and paid attention to your maintenance. Those tanks, they would take it. Yeah, the Leopard 1 was magnificent for our environment. Absolutely magnificent.
You mentioned earlier that the unit was full of real warriors. Can you tell me about your first commander?
Yep, my first commander was actually a British soldier. His name was Chris Mander. I think he went on to become the RSM of one of the Royal Tank Regiments. But he was over on exchange. We have this active exchange program between the British and the Australians, and, you know, more recently, the Americans. And so Chris was, you know, I kind of idolized him as well, because he wore a funny uniform. He had this black tank suit and spoke with a funny accent. But I think Chris was probably on a learning curve as well at the time. He, you know, like I say, we operate tanks in a very different way to the old chieftains that he would have been used to. Navigation, our guys could navigate, our commanders could navigate, and I think Chris probably struggled with his navigation at that time, you know, because they're so fast and the terrain's so variable in Australia. As a tank commander, you have to be right on point with your land navigation. This is in the days before GPS and all that sort of stuff. And I remember at Woomera that each tank pulled out an old sun compass, like the, you know, they would have fought in North Africa in the Second World War. They had a sun compass with a little needle, you know. Chris was a great first commander. He looked after me. And after Chris, he went on some leave after that exercise, and I got this Australian tank commander, a corporal, and he took me under his wing as well. And, you know, he's still one of my friends today. He's an amazing guy. He went on right through as Corps RSM, etc.
I was going to ask how you did navigate, because I've never been to Australia, but I can imagine there are some geographical features you can navigate by, but in some areas there's perhaps not that many.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of it. It makes you a better crewman, better commander. I think the types of terrain that we operated in throughout the Cold War and later, you know, we were operating them, those leopards, up in Shoalwater Bay in the really close tropical Queensland country, you know, to places like Woomera. And later on, across the top of Australia, right across the top end of Australia, in the, you know, the terrain that varies from tropical to arid. Yeah, and so as a commander, you just got really good at map to ground navigation. In fact, I remember I was a young trooper still during the Cold War, and I'd been selected to be a bit of an experiment. Me and another guy, we'd performed pretty well as tank crewmen, and they said, let's try these two young guys out and put them on the commander's course. So I was actually a trooper tank commander, and navigation was the thing that was going to make or break us. And I remember just scraping through by the skin of my teeth on land navigation, because those instructors, my God, by day or by night, they could just sort of sense where they were. That's one thing. I'm in awe of some of those early guys that trained me. You know, they were magnificent navigators, and controlling their crews while they're reading a map by red light in the dark. Just incredible.
Did you have any NBC training?
We were trained in all the NBC stuff. We had a modified British NBC suit. The dark green charcoal lined NBC suit. And we used the American M17A1 respirator, which was a pile of junk. I hated that thing. You know, you couldn't change the filters without taking the mask off. So I don't know what we were ever supposed to do once those filters were full of agent. But anyway,
that seems like a major design fault.
Yeah, they're the same masks that the Americans took to the first Gulf War. I think if the Cold War had gone hot, the Americans in an NBC environment, the Americans would have been in real strife with those masks. They were a pile of junk, and I seem to remember they had a breathing ratio 4 to 1 or something. So it was 4 times harder than normal to breathe through them. And when they eventually got replaced by the magnificent British S10 gas masks or respirators, oh my God, you could actually breathe. And you know, you could actually see. They had the British ones were leaps and bounds ahead of those American masks. But yeah, for the first part of my career, we had those rubbish M17A1 masks, and they made us. You know, we had sort of NBC week in the regiment, so you'd be servicing your tank in NBC environment, and you know, learning how to drink and learning how to detect, learning how to go to the toilet in an NBC environment, all that sort of crap. But Leopard had an overpressure system. So in theory, you didn't even need to mask up while you're in the tank, but our practice was always, you know, full personal NBC equipment plus the vehicle NBC protection system. But we hated it. We hated the NBC training. It was just like all the tank soldiers that I've heard, they hated it, you know. I remember one exercise, you know, we're out for a few days in this NBC environment and you're looking through the periscopes and all the kangaroos are hopping by and they're fine. You know, there's no NBC. And the troop leader would say, you know, I can see kangaroos outside. They're doing fine. Can we open up? And the answer over the radio was, of course, no, suck it up.
Sounds like NBC week was always a very popular
occasion. It was horrible because you'd do PT, you know, you'd do physical training in NBC and, you know, guys you can barely breathe. It's like breathing through a drinking straw while you're running. Ever try that? That'll give you some simulation of it. It's just horrible, yeah.
Did the Leopard have river fording capabilities? Did it have a snorkel or anything like that?
Just with its own short snorkel, it could go 2.25 meters, so up to the turret roof or over the turret roof, and then there was a big snorkel you could put on where you could drive literally under the water 4 meters in depth, and it was, unlike a lot of tanks, it was pretty easy to prepare. It, you know, you had a little bicycle pump inside that had sealed the turret ring, and this other pump which would close all the various flaps for the engine and all that sort of stuff, and away you go. We regularly forded creeks, you know, in the tropical north particularly, just by making sure that our fording capability was up to scratch. You could go through creeks that other vehicles would have to turn away from. Yeah, Leopard was good as far as fording, yeah.
I can't imagine being reliant on a bicycle pump to ensure your tank is waterproof.
You imagine the little gap between the turret and the hull had the turret ring seal. So it was literally like a rubber bike tube that you had this little cranky pump thing, and I forget what the barometric pressure you had to make sure it was up to before you were waterproof, but yeah, you did, and it works. That's, you know, it's German design, beautiful.
And what was it like driving a tank underwater?
As a driver, I remember the first time it was you're out in the daylight, you're viewing the world through your periscopes, and then you hear driver advance, and down you go down the ramp through a fording pool. We had a fording pool or a lake, our local lake, Loch Lee, and your vision would go, all of a sudden you'd see the water coming, and then it'd go sort of light tan, and then it'd go dark brown, then black, completely black, and then water pissing in through the hatch seal, because they're waterproof, but they're not that waterproof. And so, you would be, like a bad submarine movie from, this Dust Boot, where the water's, pouring in through the hatches. It's just like that. And so, you've got little bilge pumps inside, and they're pumping out any water that gets in. But, very capable. And you could actually just sit in there as long as the engine was running. They would burble away, and gave you real confidence in that wagon. It was a great tank for that sort of thing.
I interviewed a T-72 tank commander with the East Germans, and he didn't like doing the snorkel practice. I think it was a bit more effort to set up, whereas it sounds like the Leopard had it to quite a fine art in terms of how quickly it could be configured.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've actually seen an old DDR training film on preparing the T-72, they couldn't escape through their snorkel. Our snorkel was, just an extension of the commander's hatch. So, your crew could get out, whereas I think in a T-72, if it failed, oh, my God, you're trapped underwater. That would just been horrific. Yeah, I wouldn't have liked to have gone underwater in a Soviet tank.
Coming back to the Soviets, I mean, 1989 comes round. Could you remember where you were when you heard that the Berlin Wall had opened?
I think I was in the field. I heard it on the radio, like on the BBC World Service or the ABC or something like that, just tuned in low, and someone said, shit, the Berlin Wall's come down. And then I thought, yeah, but I'm tired and I've got to go and pick it soon. And that was my Berlin Wall experience. Yeah, I seem to remember I was in the field and something leaps out at me that I was in Northern Australia at the time, like surrounded by mosquitoes and, termite mounds. So, yeah, it was a bit of a contrast to being in Berlin with the wall coming down. But, yeah.
When you had some time to contemplate it, did you think, this is really going to change things as far as my role?
Yes and no. Of course, the Soviets were on our mind, in the back of our mind, particularly with the exchange programs we had with British, because we were pretty kept up to date with the inner German border and the Third Shock Army and, all that sort of thing. But, there was also that focus of war up in the archipelago to our north and fighting in jungles like our fathers and grandfathers would have, we were still focused on regional defense as well, I guess. And when the I do remember when the wall came down, our training enemy changed as well. They really focused not so much on fighting Soviet style motor rifle divisions, but more insurgents. And so they changed from the Missourians at the time to this other mythical enemy called the Khmerians, which were much poorer than the Missourians and much not as well equipped. You know, they had AK-47s and, you know, rented Toyota Land Cruisers and things like that. So yeah. We'd gone back to
metric.
So I guess we were lucky, you know, at the time, because, you know, some of the guys who stayed in after I went, you know, they ended up in actually fighting insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan and things like that, you know. So that change in focus probably did us no harm. We were there was always that mindset that if you're trained to fight conventionally, you can switch to asymmetric warfare quite easily. But if you just train for insurgencies or asymmetric warfare, the training leap to conventional war is too big. So we were lucky. We had both.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. And I believe that in 89 there was a big exercise, Kangaroo 89. Really original with the names of your exercises in Australia.
Oh yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. They put a lot of thought into that. Yeah.
Part two will be in a few weeks' time, where we hear about Tim's experiences on Kangaroo 89 and his meeting with an East German tank commander. Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.